Just before the millennium, I had the opportunity to participate in a number of conferences and keynote programs regarding world conditions during that period of time. It was interesting to me because although the speakers, the scientists, the engineers, the philosophers, religious leaders from around the world came from such very, very different perspectives, they all saw something very, very similar happening at that point in the history of our world. They were all in agreement that we are living the greatest challenges of recorded human history, bar none. They were in agreement that the choices that we're making at this time, in this generation, do in fact have the power to preserve or destroy all that we love and all that we hold dear. Well, it's within the context of those great challenges that we also documented the existence of the field of intelligence that bathes creation, the field that we spoke of earlier, and at the same time that we documented the existence of an intelligent message within the bodies of all life. So when we take these together, the fact that we are living in such a unique time, this very precarious point in human history, and that this intelligence within us is mirrored around us as well. Through these relationships, we are given a power, if we choose to accept this power, to become better people in our lives and to participate in the events of life and even to create a better world. William Blake said that God is man and exists in us and we in him. Blake goes on to say that God became as we are, that we may be as he is. What a powerful, powerful statement. God became as we are, that we may be as he is. If we get past the gender references in this phrase, we begin to see perhaps the deepest meaning of what William Blake is saying. We're going to address the gender here in just a little while. What William Blake is saying is there's a force. The force that is responsible for creation in our universe became as we are and lives within us so that we may use that force and strive to become the best that we can possibly be, to take advantage of that power that lives within us, to participate in the world around us. Well, in the early years of the 21st century, we do in fact have at our fingertips the power to preserve or destroy all that we cherish as a species. We've sent extensions of our eyes and ears through our technology. We've sent machines to the very edge of our solar system, and now even beyond our solar system. Pioneer 10 is on its way into deep, deep space in an effort to discover more about the universe we live in and ultimately about ourselves. We now have the ability to peer into the womb of a living woman at the instant that a sperm and an egg unite. We can actually see that DNA being exchanged between those cells. Our technology gives us the power to do all of these things on the one hand. On the other hand, we're still asking the same question at the beginning of this century that we asked at the beginning of the last century. Who are we? Who are we? What the research is beginning to show, and what the ancient texts say in the language of their time, when they answer this question very specifically, they say that we are the spirit of God. The spirit of the intelligence in these greater realms expressing through bodies of earth. Spirit of God, bodies of earth. In segment 2, we mentioned that only 4% of our universe as we know it is physical, while the remainder is made of a form of energy that really isn't well understood, and that 4% that is physical is made of the same elements that make up our bodies: hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, and carbon. Well, this is fascinating. Think about the implications, if you will. What makes this so interesting is that as bodies of Earth, we would expect to be made of the same stuff as the world that we occupy. This is not the case, however. While we are hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, carbon, our world, the Earth, is mostly made of oxygen, iron, silicon, and magnesium. What this suggests is that our composition is actually closer to the universe in general than to the specific world that we occupy. And I think that's fascinating because it says we may in fact be from the stars, as so many of the ancients have suggested. Well, through the ancient sciences, we are shown just how deep this relationship really extends. Earlier in this program, I described an ancient science of applying numbers to the letters of the ancient alphabets. We identified this as the ancient study of gematria. And what we said earlier was that for every letter of every ancient alphabet, including the English that we use today, there are precise, specific numbers linked to those letters. No one knows really where these numbers came from. They've been with us for a long time, some over 4,000 years. I'd like to use this science, the science of gematria, to demonstrate a relationship that you might find surprising. And in this relationship, it will give us an even deeper understanding into the question of who we are and perhaps how we relate to the world around us and the world within us. In the rules of gematria, I mentioned there are 32 of those rules, and we won't go through all 32 of them today. What I would like to do, however, is share three very key rules, and then let's apply them and see how this science works and see what it might be saying to us about our lives. The first partial rule of gematria simply says to us that numbers and letters are interchangeable. When we see the letter of an ancient alphabet, and we see the charts where that letter is linked to a specific number, we can replace one for the other, and we're talking about the same thing. Numbers and letters are interchangeable. The second partial rule says that numbers may be reduced until they exist as a single digit. For example, if we had the number 100, we could add a 1 plus a 0 and a 0, and the number 1 from this perspective and the number 100 are interchangeable. Or if we had the number 12, we could add 1 plus 2 and it would become a 3. And the 3 and the 12 at their very, very deepest levels are related and have a similar meaning. A third partial rule simply says that numbers that are equal in value are equal in meaning. For example, if you have two words that represent two very different things in our world, and we assign the specific numbers to every letter of those words, and we reduce those numbers, and we find that both words, even though they are different in meaning, have the same numeric value, then what we can say is that those words in their deepest level are related in meaning. Let's look at an example just to see precisely how this works. I'm going to use two words, the word heaven and the word soul. And this work is adapted from the work of a brilliant rabbi, Rabbi Benjamin Black, who illustrates this power of gematria in his writings. So we're going to go into the Hebrew language because that is the language that lends itself so purely to the numbers. And this is also in your guidebook, so you can follow along there as well. We'll begin with the word soul. And typically, when we speak of the word soul, we think of soul as being something that resides within us. In Hebrew, the word for soul is neshama, neshama. And when Hebrew words are written, the vowels are omitted. So the Hebrew is written as a language of consonants. So in the Hebrew language, soul is represented by the letters N, S, H, M, and H. And when we go into the ancient charts and we apply the numbers from any text of Kabbalah, you'll find these numbers, to each of these letters, what we find is that the N is represented by a 50, the SH by a 300, the M by a 40, and the H by a 5. And if we add those numbers together, remember we can reduce those numbers to a single digit. They become the number 395, and a 3 plus a 9 plus a 5 becomes the letter 8. And from this perspective, in the ancient science of gematria, the number 8 is soul. 8 and soul are one and the same. Okay, now let's do the same thing with the word heaven. We're actually using the heaven. In Hebrew, that word is ha-shamayim. And again, the vowels are omitted. So we have the consonants H, S, H, M, Y, and M because we're speaking the heaven. And if we apply the numbers from the Kabbalistic charts to those letters, the H becomes a 5, the SH becomes a 300, the M becomes a 40, the Y becomes a 10, and the M becomes a 40 again if you're doing this at home on your own. These are very different numbers than we saw for the word soul. However, when we add these numbers together, they result in the number 395, and a 3 plus a 9 plus a 5, as we saw earlier, becomes an 8. And what we see is that from the perspective of gematria, the word soul and the word the heaven are one and the same. When we say the word heaven, people typically move their hands away from them in a gesture toward the skies above them, suggesting that the heaven is something beyond our bodies, while the soul is something within our bodies. What this examination through gematria is saying to us is that at the deepest levels, we may actually be experiencing heaven within us as well as the world around us, and that the soul that we believe is confined to our bodies is part of something greater, is part of the heavens. From this perspective, heaven and soul are equal. Now, let's carry this analysis one step further and look at the ancient name of God from the same perspective. In the ancient traditions, one name was held so sacred that even today it's never spoken in Orthodox Jewish traditions. There was one name that was held so sacred that it was replaced over 6,800 times in the original Hebrew Torah with a substitute name to protect its power and to honor its sacredness. It is this single name. When King Solomon began to build the Temple of Israel, he wrote this name on a parchment and placed it under the cornerstone, and it said that that name remains today. This is the name, the ancient name of God, the personal name of God, that was revealed through the texts over 3,000 years ago, and it is the name that also we find in the cells of our bodies. Though the true pronunciation of this name has been hidden throughout the ages, we are not certain today precisely how this name was actually pronounced. We are certain, however, of the letters that represent the name, because they've been found in the oldest records of the original Torah, copies of the Kabbalah, and even in some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, before those records were edited and replaced in later time. So read in their original form, Hebrew is read from right to left. The letters are the ancient letters Y, H, V, H, or in the Hebrew alphabet, Yud, He, Vav, He. And we write these in English from left to right, they simply become the letters YHVH. Well, according to the Hebrew texts that link over one half of the world's population through the writings of the prophet Abraham, the 2 billion Judeo-Christian and the 1 billion Islam followers, this name, the name Yahweh or Yah, is the personal name given to the creator of this world. So although we do not know the precise pronunciation, the overwhelming majority of scholarly opinion believes that the name represented by YHVH is just that, Yahweh or Yah, Y-A-H. The words are used and written interchangeably. It is this name that we also find coded as the DNA in the cells of our bodies in all life, the name Yahweh. Well, if we apply the number values that were assigned over 4,000 years ago through gematria to these four letters, YHVH, we will derive the hidden number code for God's ancient name. So let's do this. If we pull up the chart of the Hebrew letters and we see precisely which numbers correspond to the letters, what we find is that the Y or the Yud becomes a 10, the H or the He becomes a 5, the Vav or the V becomes a 6, and the H, the final H, becomes a 5 once again. So YHVH, the ancient name of God, actually equates to the numbers 10, 5, 6, and 5. When we add these numbers together, they give us the number 26, and in gematria, words equal in value or equal in meaning, and we can also reduce the numbers to a single digit. 26, 2 plus 6 equals 8. And now what we see is that the ancient name of God has the value of 8, precisely the same value as soul, precisely the same value as heaven. So from the perspective of this ancient science, of looking deeper into the meaning of the world and the mysteries around us, God, soul, and heaven are equal in value. The heaven that surrounds us is within us. The soul within us is part of all that we see, and God, the creative force or the intelligence that is responsible for all, is within us as well as around us. The message in our cells reminds us that God's ancient name lives within each of us in the most intimate way imaginable at the very core of life itself. So clearly, these number codes, they don't imply that we are God. What they say is that we share. We share in the power and the intelligence that is responsible and underlies the existence of our world. The texts so eloquently state that we share in these qualities of God. We are, however, left to choose how we apply our God-like attributes to fulfill our greatest potential in life in this world. And the choice is up to us. Ancient texts specifically state that our bodies are specially made to contain this spark described as God's spirit. And they describe it in a number of different ways. And what I'd like to do is share with you from some very rare texts, some perhaps that you've never heard of before, recently discovered only in the 20th century, that help us perhaps to understand even clearer how this power, the intelligence within us, how we are built to receive and house the intelligence the ancients called the temples of our bodies, how the temples of our bodies are built to house the spirit or the spark or the light of God. One of the first texts I'd like to explore is a text from the ancient Mandaeans. The Mandaeans today are the only Gnostic sect to have survived from ancient into modern times. Interestingly, they're found today only in the remote areas of southern Iraq and Iran. They have a number of documents that clearly describe the creation of humankind, the first of our species, and the creation of the soul that was placed into humankind and what had to happen for that marriage to occur. And the first document that I'd like to share from the Gnostic book of the Mandaeans is entitled The Creation of the World and the Alien Man. And from this perspective, the alien man is us, it's humankind. The creation of the world and the alien man begins by describing how Adam was created first as a body and how his soul was placed into him secondarily. And this is a direct quote. They created Adam, and they laid him down, but there was no soul in him. When they created Adam, they were unable to cast a soul into him. The text described how Adam's body had to be modified and changed from its original form, finding the precise recipe so that it could house the power or the spark or the light of God's spirit. And the text goes on to say it was only after what they call the radiance of life, Adam's soul spoke in him, that Adam opened his eyes in the bodily trunk. Well, when we go into other traditions, and many of you have heard me speak in our last program, Speaking the Lost Language of God, I described how our most cherished traditions had been edited in the 4th century, in the year 325 AD, by the Catholic Church. We know that at least 45 documents were either changed or removed from those original texts. Well, this is with the Christian traditions. What I did not mention at that time was that the same kinds of edits happened in other traditions, including the Hebrew traditions. There are a number of books and documents that were excluded from the Hebrew Bible that were never canonized on the one hand, while on the other hand, they're important documents. They tell us about our world and about our relationship with one another and God. And one of those is the ancient Hebrew book of the Agada. And in the Agada, there is a section that is entitled The Soul of Man. And it's in this section where the book begins to give details describing what sets humankind's soul apart from the souls of other forms of life. In all other forms of life, the texts say that God fashioned those souls through the Word of God those souls were formed. However, and this is a direct quote from the Agada, when it comes to fashioning Adam's soul and the first soul of humankind, it said that God fashioned Adam's soul with particular care. That God fashioned Adam's soul with particular care. And I mentioned earlier that if there were any questions about the gender of who God is, that we would address that momentarily, and this is the place where that happens. Because the next portion of this statement suggests something very, very different from what we've been led to believe in the past. So I'll read the statement, God fashioned Adam's soul with particular care. She is the image of God. She is the image of God. Suggesting that while Adam's body was certainly masculine, it was male, that his soul is feminine, number one, and number two, that his feminine soul mirrors the image of God. And the text goes on to say that as God fills this world, so the soul fills the human body. This is a fascinating statement to me, because we're led to believe that God is everywhere in all things in the world around us. And in a similar fashion, our soul is everywhere all the time within our bodies. The book of Agada goes on to say that the soul of man was created on the first day of creation, for the soul is the Spirit of God. And there we have it. The soul is the Spirit of God moving upon the face of the waters. Thus, instead of being the last act of creation, humankind is really the first work of creation, because the very first work was the Spirit of God moving upon the face of the earth. Certainly, these texts are open to interpretation, and they're very controversial. I'm sharing them because they give insights that we do not often see in other traditions, suggesting, number one, that our souls and our bodies were formed separately from one another. Number two, that our body had to be changed a number of times, and the texts are never really clear on precisely how many times that happened, so that we could hold the power, the spark of God, the light of God in this world. Number three, that the soul that lives within us in this refined recipe that holds that soul is actually the Spirit of God within us, the Spirit of God expresses in our world. So these texts are suggesting our bodies are the union of the heaven and the earth, and they appear to be the precise recipe required for us to contain the qualities that set us apart from all other life. We mentioned in the first segment now that a message has been found within our bodies that actually echoes precisely these understandings, going so far as to actually have the ancient name of God within every cell. So, our bodies are the union of heaven and earth. Now science is beginning to tell us precisely how that union has come together. We'll begin with that topic in the next session.